Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics.
Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. My name is Chris Jackson.
And my name is Enrico Belmonte.
And we completed had a podcast fairly recently, and it turns out that we talk very slowly, or we cover topics so thoroughly that we didn't cover everything we set out to cover in the previous podcast. We're talking about reliability metrics in different industries and different sectors. And we talked about consumer products where warranty reliability is important, electronic components where they have this crazy reliability metric called FITS, and the defense sector as well, which is madly obsessed with the MTBF. And we realized that there's actually a lot more to talk about. And I think two of the things that we want to talk about in terms of reliability metrics in this Reliability Metrics Part 2 podcast is medical devices and software. Is that right, Enrico?
Yeah. And I have also another point I want to add from the previous podcast episode. Mm-hmm. And this is more a reflection. Because reliability is defined by the customers, not defined by the company. So it's the customer decides whether the product is reliable or not. And nowadays, there are a lot of metrics that measure the consumer satisfaction. For example, consumer star rating on Amazon. And consumer star rating is driving other consumers to buy the same things, because if you see, for example, that product gets just 3 stars out of 5, you probably look for an alternative, right? But what is this consumer star rating saying to us? But basically, this is a general topic. What are saying the consumers about products? What my opinion is that when you buy a product, you test it for, let's say, a week, a month, and then you can drop a review, right? It's like when you go to holiday, then you will be asked for feedback, and you're not giving the feedback after 1 year, but after 1 week. And if you don't do it in a week, you forget it. So basically, these kind of consumer-related metrics, they are a picture of a short time. And there, so since reliability is basically a metric of a long time. Is there any way to measure in terms of consumer satisfaction? Because, you know, if reliability is typical, credible metrics for brand reputation. I want to buy a product of the same brand if I know that the product is durable. So if I have a good experience, but the experience is not related to just one couple of months, right? It's related to 5 years, 10 years. I will buy a new Mercedes because I had one and I had no problem, for example. But do you have any idea how to include reliability in this consumer-related rating?
That's a really good question, because one of the things that gets muddled in that conversation is it's called product returns that can be triggered, for example, by the product not working or the consumer not being happy with it. So, for example, if a consumer has purchased a smart lock from a hardware store, but that smart lock is very difficult to install, that will likely get returned to the hardware store. If another smart lock, which is easy to install, fails within the next first week or so, it will also get returned to the hardware store. Now, in terms of tracking, most hardware stores would essentially classify those two events as identical. Customer brought these things back and nominally would be attributed to, failures, you would argue, even if it's conceptual failure or otherwise. So it's very difficult to use the traditional concept of reliability. I know that in the FAMIAs, and there's a whole bunch of stuff on FAMIAs and Ascendo reliability, but in FAMIAs that I facilitate, I insist on us having, you know, avatars or characters, three people. We create these fictitious people which represent the different users or maintainers or operators of whatever it is we're making. And we treat our product as being difficult to use as a failure. So for example, I use smart locks as a central example. If one of my avatars is a guy called Desmond, and he is an older gentleman who wants to use a smart lock to help with his accessibility problem. So if the size of the numbers on the keypad is too small for Desmond's deteriorating eyesight, that's a failure. And many, let's call it traditional reliability engineers, would say that's not a failure. It's not designed to meet the requirements or what have you. And I used to be that person, but these days it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. If the customer thinks it's a failure, it's a failure. It doesn't matter if it's been designed to spec in terms of the specs that you imagine internally or anything else. It's the customer tells you if it's failed to meet their expectations. And that can be the smart lock catching fire when it shouldn't catch fire, or that can be the smart lock being difficult to, the keypad being difficult to visualize. And so I think it's incredibly challenging to the extent that you risk trying to quantify the unquantifiable. But I will say that the star rating is way more important, at least in North America. So for example, Home Depot and the big, which is a big hardware store across all of North America and Canada, including Canada, they will sell products which they don't manufacture. And a smart lock is a good example. So they will establish relationships with suppliers where they go into a contract with suppliers. Suppliers, it then allows those suppliers to mass produce, drive the price down of those products, and Home Depot can sell those things. Now, those suppliers, if Home Depot is starting a brand new relationship with one of those suppliers, and let's say that supplier produces smart locks, and this is the first time that they've interacted with Home Depot. They produce these smart locks, Home Depot starts selling them, and they get that low star rating. Home Depot will never do business with that organization again, ever. So it's not just the consumers who react to the star rating, it's the organizations like Home Depot, which will come down financially on its supply chain networks when those star ratings start coming in. And those star ratings are a combination of usability, reliability, and all sorts of other things that are very difficult once they're included in a star rating to then tease out again. So it's a difficult question to answer. All I know is that nominal star rating, which we all have at least in our heads, is influenced by reliability along with a bunch of other things.
But for a short time, right? So the brand reputation is not based on star rating, I would say. Yeah. Or it might be also based on star rating, but is the star rating is not including a long time experience the consumer had.
I would agree with that. The failures that tend to influence the star ratings are those infant mortality ones. If I buy something from Amazon and it fails immediately, I'm more likely to leave it one star or two star review than if that thing fails 3 years later. I'm less likely to remember, oh, I got this through Amazon. I'm going to go back to a star rating.
Therefore, I'm saying it's quite hard to get reliability in a consumer rating. And this is the picture that the consumer star rating is showing is just so a partial one. Yeah? Whereas company who produce and manufacture reliable products, they build the reputation, you know, that is basically written nowhere. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because we don't have metrics to measure it, but it's basically anchored in the experience of the consumer, of the single consumers that talk to each other and say, okay, this product is reliable. I have a good experience. You also? Okay. Me too, and so on. And so that's create what is the brand reputation over a long time. Yeah. But it's quite astonishing that there is no way, at least until now, to measure it. Yeah.
You could argue that warranty period, advertised warranty period, is an indicator of longevity. You'd expect, based on profit margins and things like that, you'd expect the typical service life of something to extend well beyond the warranty period, as most industries can, depending on the industry, can tolerate between 1 to 10% at most of products failing during the warranty period and still making profit. So, you know, if one company has a 10-year warranty period and is still solvent, another company has a 5-year warranty period for the fundamentally the same product, it is at least an indicator which you can put a fair amount of stock in, at least when comparing products relatively. Think of the very first automobile warranty period that was first offered was 3 months. So
yeah,
we've come a long time, come a long way since then. But it is very, very challenging.
There are car makers right now that they are offering 7 years warranty. I'm not sure on which components. I'm pretty sure not on all components, but it's quite a big step forward.
Yeah. Right. And there's nominal concepts of reliability, such as electric vehicles. The drivetrains are technologically more reliable than internal combustion drivetrains, just because the technology is an inescapable fact. It doesn't preclude some EV manufacturers to pay scant regard to quality during production and therefore produce very unreliable vehicles. But technologically, EVs are much more reliable if they're built with a commensurate quality. So there's lots of challenges, but
One last point before moving to medical and software. When we talked in terms of reliability, we know we are always comparing load with load-bearing capacity, right?
Right.
And the load is stochastically distributed. So for the car sector, there might be a driver which use the car for going to supermarket just once a week or a couple of times a week, and there's the other driver who is going to use more heavily the car, right? And this is, you know, if you get in the consumer star rating or in the, say, assuming that as metrics, you get bad reviews by the second class of drivers that I just mentioned, so the heavy drivers, that is also polluting, right? The perception of the totality. Yeah. So that's another important challenge we are facing in the reliability, is how to compare stress and strength distribution overall for complete products in order to see whether, for example, the more the heavier user are related to lower reliability. Yeah. I think that's quite a fascinating topic, which includes a lot of statistic, good data, but it's something that we are starting to do now, and it was not possible some years ago.
Yeah, it's they take your point. It does, you know, for industries where longevity is a genuine concern, especially if it's not a consumer-based industry, such as an organization where you're getting suppliers to provide components and parts, or maybe entire machines that need to last a generation. That's where you need to get heavily involved with your supply chain network and in the process of making reliable stuff. That's where you generate that confidence. Moving on to medical devices, I've had a bit of experience. What have you had in terms of medical device reliability exposure?
I do not have experience, but on medical devices, I think it's something more related to safety, isn't it?
Yes, yes. And the FDA is the de facto, the Food and Drug Administration of the US government is the de facto arbiter in this space. I mean, most medical devices, if they need to be commercially successful, need to appeal to the North American market. And by extension, they need to satisfy the FDA and a lot of other governmental organizations across the world simply follow the FDA process. So, and sorry?
No, you are saying that everything is process driven.
Yeah, it's like there are very strict requirements the FDA has on, for example, FMEAs. FMEAs are mandated in many specific devices. And it's very device specific. So, for example, I was working with an injectable company making an injectable, not an EpiPen, but a pen that released an injectable drug. Mm-hmm. When you scratch the surface, there are so many ways that thing can fail. So let's just say you have a pen and the needle doesn't come out. So the patient will immediately know that they're not getting that drug injected to them. Another scenario is where the needle comes out, they stick the needle into their flesh, think they're injecting the amount of drug, but they actually don't. The drug doesn't inject. So they think the drug's been injected, but it hasn't. Another way it can fail is if they set the thing for 5 milligrams or whatever the dosage is, put it in, inject themselves, and they get a 10 milligram dosage or something else, which could something more, a higher dose, an overdose, quite literally an overdose, which, as we know, can lead to all manners of failure, of death, of failure. And so it's quite difficult to quantify that sort of reliability, safety-based reliability, to the extent that you're looking for, let's call fail-safes and design. And it's okay for products to be nominally unreliable as long as the service life of that product is well advertised. So if the device is going to be reasonably workable for 6 months based on extreme use cases, then you advertise, hey, after 6 months, you need to throw this device away, whether you use it or not. So that's where you might argue that's poor reliability if it starts to, for lack of a better term, wear out within 6 months. But it's more than okay if that is in big red letters on the side of the product and say, throw this away after 6 months, or that you might even have the pharmacist write the date by which this needs to be thrown away as additional measure. And so there's no one size fits all. I do know that people think safety and reliability is different. It is and it isn't. I just know that it's a very challenging piece to do well. And most medical devices exceed nominal reliability specifications and safety margins by some measure. But you go.
No, you were saying here there is some sort of expiring date for medical devices as for drugs. And that's quite interesting mm-hmm. approach. So, yeah, and even drugs have this expiring date, right? Because they are not, the function is disappearing after it's not so effective. Right. Yeah.
And that can also mean that the producers need to, for example, keep a sample of devices in their labs and observe them over time. So if they identify any issues with those devices, that's when they can issue a recall as a preventative safety measure. It's obviously, that's not ideal. You want to not have to do that, but that's preferable to being unaware of a latent issue and that issue then being causing deaths and all sorts of issues moving forward. So medical device is a bit challenging, and then it's interesting. And I think the FDA, in my opinion, is too formulaic. They want to see, it's just they have arbitrary requirements of what the FMEA is supposed to look like, and those reviewing those documents can often be, let's just say, too bureaucratic. But my experience with medical device companies is that they actually genuinely fear, in a healthy way, bad patient outcomes. And so they're motivated beyond what the FDA is driving them to do to make the things work.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. If anybody among the listeners work in the medical sector, I would like to hear from you. What are the metrics that you use for designing for liability products? Would be great contribution to the discussion.
And if need be, we'll make them anonymous too.
Yeah. That's also an opportunity. We wanted also to talk a little bit about software because, like for 10 years ago, the hardware and software are much more connected. Mm-hmm. And the software related issue might lead to a failure of the product itself.
Right. Yeah. And so I have a fair bit of exposure in this space, but I need to give credit where credit is due. And that exposure comes from working with Anne-Marie Neufelder. And software is so different to hardware that one of the biggest issues is hardware engineers either one, pretending software is not going to fail, or two, trying to treat software and model software reliability using hardware approaches. And for me, a recent project I was working with Anne-Marie on was where we are trying, when we're developing software, an agile development process is usually a pretty robust approach. That is where you focus on developing a part of software functionality, testing that function, that part of software you've developed, going through a process of what is called defect discovery, which you can model. And you can also model the rate at which you're discovering defects to be reasonably confident that you've identified the majority of them before you move on to the next phase or next sprint in the agile development process. And so when you do that, where you get a good handle on the extent that your software team is discovering defects during this agile development process, essentially it looks like you'll see a peak. You'll see a peak of defects you discover. You won't discover too many straight away. Then you'll create a peak of defects you discover. Then you go down the other side and you don't move on, or you're not supposed to move on until you can identify that you've gone down the other side of that peak of defect discovery.
Mm-hmm. Are you describing debugging in this case? So what I'm saying is, if for example, hardware becomes slow due to software cumulative increase of memory, for example, these kind of things that are similar to wear out mechanisms because they're time dependent and dependent also on the usage. Yeah. And can lead to failure of the smartphone, for example, or whatever product which is using some software, which is, I think, is a little bit different from debugging just failures in the software itself. I'm describing something that is accumulating over time.
Right. And so that you're talking about fielded software in that case, or software you receive that's nominally polished from, you know, whoever developed it. And to be fair, perhaps I should have prefaced my conversation about it being applicable to a certain part of software development. I do think, though, that what is fundamentally misunderstood about software is that it's not a software engineer's fault when software fails. I think that's very important to mention. The simple keystroke coding errors are easy to find, easy to fix. It's the deeper problems, which usually start with the hardware team either one, never telling the software team what the hardware is supposed to do, or two, telling the software team too late. Because if the software team has that agile development strategy in place where they have carefully meted out their different sprints, and the hardware guy comes and says, hey, that stuff you've already designed, we forgot to tell you it needs to now do this.
Mm-hmm.
That's where failures creep in. Well, not creep in, failures flood in, or defects flood in, because you need to break down something you've already designed and recode it. I don't know if I'm talking the topic at all. Yeah, it's very difficult to quantify software reliability. what you can do is quantify how well you've developed software from a reliability perspective. And you, and even though you can nominally come up with numbers and defect density, you really want to make sure you haven't destroyed your software engineer's development process by throwing them specifications later in the design process. And even though they might pass functional tests later on, and you know that software is going to be unreliable if you've messed with their approach.
Yeah. Yeah, so I definitely agree with you. And, you know, our background is from hardware engineers, right? Reliability engineers. And it would be great to involve some software engineers to discuss about it, because this is a topic that is becoming really important, you know, and impacting also the way how hardware engineers are designing the products. It's not just hardware anymore, but is including software. Working as silos, separate silos, will not work out in the future, but also in the present.
And Anne-Marie once, you know, she routinely tells me that software is expected to solve everything. So if your hardware degrades, software is expected to be able to deal with it. And that's a customer expectation. And so if you have a sensor, which software depends on, the hardware engineers need to tell the software engineers, when this sensor starts to degrade or do silly things, this is what it will look like. So the software can automatically look for that behavior and deal with it appropriately. A number of airplanes have crashed when that process
We have a lot of examples, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Great.
Do you think we've covered the topic, or we just meandered through?
No, I think for the second episode, I think it's enough. We have covered a lot of topics. There are a lot of, I think, there's much more to say in terms of metrics and sectors. But, you know, the listener that are listening to us, if you realize we are missing some important sectors, important metrics, and you want to mention them, please join us, join the discussion, and we are more than happy to answer your question or start a discussion on that.
Absolutely. And so if you do want to follow Enrico's request, go to www.ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR, where you can leave that feedback, voice messages, contacts, or written messages. You have our email addresses as well if you go to the website, but most of what we talk about comes from your suggestions. So if you have a problem which you think us talking about it for 20 to 30 minutes can help you out with, yeah, let us know. But it's a pleasure speaking with you again, Enrico.
Yeah, thank you much, Chris. It was a pleasure for me too.
We'll have to do this again sometime.
Yeah.
All right. See you all later.
Yeah, see you. Bye.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.